That's aomin.org, A-O-M-I-N for Alpha and Omega Ministries.org. And it is good to be with you. I appreciated that when he decided to introduce me, he switched over to English so I'd know when to come up. Otherwise, I just kept hearing James White, Shabir Ali. And unless someone says, buy a donkey, I don't know what they're talking about. So that's about the extent of my Afrikaans, I'm afraid. But it's good to be with you here, wherever it is we are. I have been in Lanesia, Western Area, Potchefstroom, Tembisa this morning. I've been all over the place. So I know I'm somewhere, I think I'm in Pretoria now. That's a good place to be. And so, unfortunately, I have a very limited amount of time. I have about 60 minutes to do a 90-minute presentation, so you know what that means I'm going to have to do. Hopefully, you can follow English as it is spoken very, very quickly. This is an important subject, however, because honestly, I believe that the key apologetic issue in our day and how we are being attacked by Western culture is to attack the foundation of our faith, which is the Scriptures themselves. And certainly in my experience in dealing with debates with people like Bart Ehrman and John Dominic Crossan and others, as well as dealing with Muslims in the United States, Australia, the United Kingdom, and now down here, the whole concept is to undercut our trust that we know what was written by the apostles of the Lord Jesus Christ, or even that what they wrote was inspired in the first place, but especially the idea that, well, even if what they wrote was valuable and inspired, we don't know that the Bible we hold today accurately represents what they actually wrote. And that's unfortunately an area that even many ministers are weak in. It's not something that, unfortunately, in our seminaries there's a lot of emphasis upon. And so what I wanted to do this evening is try to give you at least a brief introduction as to why we can trust the New Testament documents. As I was saying, the current onslaught is very clear. Naturalistic materialism rules the day in academia. Certainly, we have all discovered that. Anything that, for example, that does not presuppose an uncreated universe that can be explained solely on the basis of naturalism, it's rejected a priori. So you have to start with the idea of naturalism. You have to start with the idea of materialism. If you start with the idea of inspiration or anything like that, you're just automatically mocked and rejected. And, of course, Christian claims are relegated to the arena of myth. They are just simply put off to the side. And you can believe that religious stuff you want, but don't say it's actually true and don't say it's actually historical. Unfortunately, that's what's going on in academia today. As a result, many scholars spin the evidence, particularly in media appearances. The media loves unbelieving scholars. Oh my goodness, if I wanted to be popular in the media, all I have to do is become an apostate, and they'd be banging down my door to do interviews. Bart Ehrman, for example, is an apostate. He went to Moody Bible Institute, Wheaton College, and Princeton Theological Seminary, was a professing Christian, and now he isn't anymore. So the world loves him. He's been enlightened, see, and he can help the rest of us become enlightened, and that's why they're constantly talking to him. And what they say in those media appearances and in their books and so on and so forth is that all we have are copies of copies of copies of copies from hundreds of years after the originals. And so there have been all these changes, and we really can't know that when we read the book of Romans, that's what Paul wrote. We can't know if we read John, that that's what John wrote, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And most of us are left going, how do I respond to that? Well, let me ask you a question. Given that there are about 5,700 handwritten manuscripts of the New Testament. Now, that doesn't mean all 5,700 go from Matthew to Revelation. Obviously, the older the manuscript, the more likely it's going to be smaller, fragmentary. You try being a piece of paper that lasts for 2,000 years. It's pretty difficult to do. In fact, most of us wouldn't look all that good after 2,000 years. So they tend to fall apart. They tend to be damaged. And so we have about 5,700 manuscripts, some are complete, some are partial, of all the New Testament books, dating from as early as about 125 AD to as late as the 16th and 17th centuries, because even though printing was invented in the middle of the 15th century, it took a while for printing presses to be developed, it took a while for that to sort of catch on, and so handwritten copies continued to be made for quite some time, even after Gutenberg had invented the press, at least in the West. As we know, it had been invented earlier elsewhere in China and places like that. But anyways, of all those 5,700 handwritten manuscripts, how many variants do you think there might be amongst those? Now, when I say a variant, what I mean is if any manuscript spells a word differently, If any manuscript has a different word order, if any manuscript has a verse that another manuscript does not, that is a variant. So it can be, it could be as small as spelling John with two N's over against spelling John with one N. That's still considered a variant. So how many variants do you think you might have in the manuscript tradition of 5,700 manuscripts? Yes, sir. 2%. So 12,000-ish around there, okay? Anyone else? Everyone's going, okay, that guy obviously knows something, so I'm not gonna guess, I'm not gonna say anything. Anyone else wanna, yes, sir? 170,000. So I've got 170,000, 10,500. Anyone else? I've had people say, yes? Zero. We have zero to 170,000. All right. I feel like I'm on The Price is Right. All right, one more. Just yes, sir. 450 or 450,000? 450. You don't get a prize for this, guys. I'm going to get between her and him, and then, you know, one more. 0.1%. All right. Going to wake you all up here real quick. About 400,000. Now you go. Now, given that there are only 138,162 words in the New Testament, at least in the Nestle-Aland 27th edition of the Greek New Testament, that sounds like what we're saying is that there's three variants per word, like you have an option of three different ways of looking at any word in the New Testament. And as a result, we are confidently told no one can have any confidence the text they read today accurately reflects what was originally written. In fact, if you were to put it graphically, it would sort of look like that. At the top, you have the total number of words, and at the bottom, the total number of variants. And so it looks like it's a really bad situation. But now, what they don't tell you. It's always the context that is most important. First of all, 99% of all the variants found in the textual tradition do not impact the meaning of the text. In fact, unless you actually read Greek, I would not even be able to explain to you what it was outside of, for example, one of the most common variants is called the movable new. In English, you're supposed to say an apple, which is different than saying a bat. That N is supposed to help you pronounce things better. Well, there's a movable new in Greek as well, and scribes just didn't quite catch on to it real well. So there's no way to, it doesn't impact the meaning of the text. There's no way to really explain it to someone outside of that way in Greek. So it does not impact the meaning in any way, shape, or form. So 99% of them fall into that category. Hence, 1% of 400,000 is about 4,000 meaningful textual variants. But when you think about that, that comes out to about 2.9% or one meaningful variant every three pages. But only about half of those are viable. And when I say viable, if you had a scribe in the year 1400, had a bad day one morning, he gets up and he's making a copy of the New Testament and the Book of Mark someplace, and he comes up with a reading because he isn't paying attention that no one's ever seen before anywhere in the world, that's not a viable reading. It doesn't have any probability of having been the original reading. And so only about half, or a little bit less than half of those are viable. So there's about 1,500 to 2,000 viable, meaningful New Testament manuscripts. So that's quite a different picture. In fact, if we were to look at it, graphically, the bar would be much, much smaller than it was before. Now, simple fact, think about it. If we only had one manuscript of the Gospel of Mark, how many textual variants would we have? None. None at all. But if we only had one, how much confidence would we have that that is the best text of the Gospel of Mark? You see, the more manuscripts you have, the more confidence you have that you contain the original text. You still have the original readings. If you only have one manuscript, you're not going to have any textual variants, but what do you have to believe? That one guy got it perfectly right, and you can't check him out. Whoever made that one copy, they had to nail it, or we don't know what they originally said. So the more manuscripts you have, the better, actually, even though once you have two manuscripts, now you have textual variation. Once you have 10, you have more textual variants. Once you have 5,700, then you have even more. The real problem in New Testament textual criticism is the fact that we've got more manuscripts than any other book of antiquity. And that's why there's such a large number of variations. It's not that the text is impure. It's just that once you have that many manuscripts, you're going to have that many more textual variants in the process. So when you think about it, 5,700 plus catalog manuscripts in the New Testament, average length, somewhere around minimally 200 pages. That's over 1.3 million pages of text. Some people would actually say it's as much as 400 pages average, so it's over 2 million pages of handwritten text. We're not talking photocopies here. For you young folks, there was no cut and paste back then. It would have been nice. Some of us are older folks. You know, I remember doing lots of my papers in college and university on the IBM Selectric. Ooh, remember that one? Some of you are going, yeah, and some younger folks are going, what? Yeah, what are you talking about? But that was when men were men. So anyways, 1,500 to 2,000 meaningful and viable variants, over 1.3 million pages of hand-copied text spending approximately 1,500 years prior to the invention of printing is an amazingly small percentage of the text, reflecting an amazingly accurate history of transmission. One might say it's downright miraculous. A couple of years ago, I asked my computer to compare the two most dissimilar printed Greek texts that we have. One represents what's, for those of you who know something about textual criticism, the Alexandrian text. One represents the Byzantine text. These are the most dissimilar families of manuscripts that we have. And I asked my computer to mark in green where there is a difference between the most dissimilar printed texts. And you will see here in Ephesians 1, there are what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's actually a little one right down there at verse 14, which is actually an important little textual variant. It's the difference between has and ha. In regards to the Holy Spirit, it's whether you use a neuter or a masculine pronoun there in Ephesians 1:14, who is the down payment of our inheritance. But as you can see, the idea that there are three options per word is not what we have. The vast majority of that text, there is no issue whatsoever as to what the original reading was. And guess which book of the New Testament has the least number of textual variants? It's one thing during a presentation, but when you're right at the heart of the sermon, and La Cucaracha starts, it really throws everything right out the window. But guess which book of the New Testament has the purest textual tradition? It is the book of Hebrews. Hebrews. I guess everyone didn't understand it back then, so they didn't change anything then either. So here's Hebrews 6, 8 through 20. And there's only three little spots there, and one of them's just a definite article, which isn't going to make any difference at all. So an extremely, and think about it, handwritten. I mean, if I passed this out in Greek to the front row and asked you to copy it and give your copy to the next row and to the next row and the next row, we couldn't get it through this room with that level of purity, let alone this has been done over the course of almost 2,000 years. But, obviously, even the 1,500 to 2,000 number needs to be understood. Even when the variant does impact the reading, in the large majority of the instances, the careful student of the text can see which reading is the original reading. Many of these errors involve common scribal errors, mistakes we continue to make to this very day when copying from one text to another. Here's an interesting example if you want to look it up in your Bible. If you want to look at 1 John chapter 3, verse 1, you might want to just see how your Bible reads at this point. I think I know how most of your Bibles would. But in the King James Version, 1 John 3:1, we read, "Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore, the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not." Now, compare that with the New American Standard Bible that says, "See how great a love the Father has bestowed on us, that we would be called the children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us, because it did not know him." Now, for the gentlemen in the audience who are colorblind, the phrase, "and such we are," is in red. And so you will notice that there's a difference between the two. Now, less scrupulous people who don't understand the process of how we receive the text and how Bible translations are done might look at that and go, "Those Anglicans that translated the King James, I knew they didn't like the concept of adoption, so they just cut it right out of there, just deleted it from the Bible." And whenever you hear anybody talking about people deleting stuff and cutting stuff out, unless it's the Jehovah's Witness Bible or Joseph Smith and the Mormon Bible, that's fair. That's a fair criticism. But that's not what's going on with meaningful translations of the Bible. So why is there a difference between the two? Well, the modern texts contain an important phrase affirming the adoption as children of God that is not found in the KJV. Why is that? Well, this is a glowing example of a word, by the way. To leave this evening, you will have to be able to pronounce We're going to have some big university rugby players at the door, so you can't leave until you pronounce for them this word, homoiteluton. Okay, that is the code word for leaving the room today is homoiteluton, and homoiteluton means similar endings. Similar endings. You're all really sad tonight because of what happened last night. That's now I understand. It's like, don't talk about rugby because those guys in the black shirts did it again. I know what's going on. It's a you're all a little bit down. You know, I noticed the music was a little bit slower. I understand. It's okay. Anyways, homoiteluton, similar endings. Think of how many times you've been copying something, and again, this is a little bit easier to talk to older folks about this because younger folks just select, copy, paste. That's all there is to it anymore. But it used to be you actually had to sit there, and you have to have a book open. You had to type it out. You actually had to copy it out of your source. And as you're doing so, let's say you're copying the word education. It ends with T-I-O-N. And you type education, and you look back, and you see T-I-O-N, and you continue on from there. But the problem is that T-I-O-N is at the end of the word indication on the next line. And now, inadvertently, in your copying, you have deleted an entire line of text. And if you're not paying attention, you may not even notice it. It still make perfect sense, actually, at that point. Unless you go back and proofread it, you're probably not even going to realize that you've made that kind of mistake. This is similar endings, I-N-G, E-S, T-I-O-N, so on and so forth. That same thing happened in Greek as well. And thankfully, we have lots of manuscripts of 1 John. And today, we have lots of tremendous resources available to us. This, for example, is from the Logos Library. I normally use Accordance, but for some reason I had used Logos for this one, I guess because it looked pretty on the screen. But what you can do is, I should have brought my little laser thing with me so I could point to does that have a, no, it's just a recorder. Normally I point up there to the little square on the third line next to the word chi, and then a little slanted red line on the next line next to esmen. You go down over to the little square on this side, and you have a few letters there. That tells those who learn how to read these things which manuscripts do not contain that phrase, and we are, which includes some manuscripts of the Vulgate. And actually, a majority of texts do not have and we are in it. But that doesn't really tell you why this particular error took place. Let me show you why the error took place. Here is what the phrase would have looked like, or at least 1 John 3 looks like, in the original language. Now, what you need to understand is that for the first 800 to 900 years of the transmission of the New Testament text, it was written in majuscule. All capital forms, no spaces between words, and almost no punctuation. All capital letters, no spaces between words, and almost no punctuation whatsoever. Think about what that looks like and how difficult that is to read. And so here is what it looked like, and let me use some color here to show you what happened. And where'd the color go? Come on, you're in there. You're in here somewhere. Did I forget to copy? No. I didn't. I knew I put the color in here. Maybe I didn't. Well, if you look at the beginning of the second line, you see the letters M-E-N in English anyways. Then go down the line just a little bit, you'll find another set of M-E-N. That's the beginning of and we are. And so the person wrote the word kleithomen, that we might be called children of God. Then their eyes went back, they saw the end, the M-E-N at the end of and we are, continued on from there, inadvertent deletion of the phrase. It has nothing to do with Anglicans not loving the doctrine of adoption or anything like that at all. I need to fix my colors on that one before I do that again. So, There it is. It was just one screen down from where it was supposed to be. There you see the similar endings, and you can see how that intermediate material could be very easily deleted by someone in the process of copying. And again, if we only had one copy of 1 John, we'd have a problem. Because if that error had been made in the one copy we have, we wouldn't know that John originally wrote, and we are. But this is what's good about having multiple copies, because we can then compare them with one another, and this kind of error simply doesn't impact us. Now, the majority of the 5,700-plus Greek manuscripts date after 1000 AD. That's a fact. You need to be aware of that. That makes sense when you think about it. I mean, the older the manuscripts are, the more difficult it's going to be for them to survive that lengthy period of time of transmission. The earlier texts are normally called papyri texts, written in uncial or majuscule text. Papyri was made by taking the leaves of the papyrus plant, laying them at 90-degree angles to one another and pressing them together. It made for a cheap writing material, but also one that wouldn't be as long-lasting as vellum manuscripts, which are made out of animal hides. And as I mentioned, uncial text, all capital forms, no spacing, no punctuation. Here's a graphic of the manuscripts by how they appear in history. You will notice that the blue are the papyri, the green are the uncials, and then the minuscules. Eventually, somebody got the idea, hey, you know, if we use big letters and small letters and spaces between words and punctuation, it's easier to read. And around the 9th century, that developed, and you can see it took over very, very quickly. But you can see the majority of these manuscripts come from after the 10th century, after 1000 AD, which makes sense just simply because of the age of the manuscripts and things like that. Now, one of the things I like to do, and I'm not going to be able to tell you all my stories. I love telling stories about these things because I am a geek. Brother Rudolph has just sat down front here. He is the man who has been taking care of me most of the time I've been here, and he will confess to you if you want to talk to him afterwards. Can you give us some examples of how geeky James White is? And he already has a bucket load of examples of this particular weirdness on my part. So I love biblical manuscripts, and so I love showing them and telling you stories, especially when I've gotten to see them and gotten to examine them. But I'm going to have to keep that really short this evening because of time. Let me show you this. This is manuscript P52. This is about the size of a credit card. It is written on both sides. For some reason, Christians, and scholars have no idea why this happened, but Christians always preferred to write in a book form rather than a scroll form. Even though scrolls were very prevalent in the first century, we have almost no Christian scrolls at all. Christians just love the book form, and so they would write on both sides. This is made, you can see how it's made out of papyri. You can even see the cross-hatching of the papyrus leaves in it. And it's written on both sides. It was discovered by a man who was rummaging through manuscripts and little fragments that had come from Egypt in the British Library. Actually, I don't think it was British Library. It was one of the universities in England. And what happened was he recognized it was a biblical manuscript. And of course, the British had been running around stealing everybody else's property for a long, long time and shipping it back to London, and that's how it got there. But once it was discovered, it was sent to the four leading papyrologists of the day. Three of the four dated it to between 100 and 150 AD, and one put it into the first century, so between about 90 to 110 AD in that time frame. And so this is the earliest fragment we have in the New Testament. What's amazing to me is it is from the Gospel of John. Now, why is that amazing? Because if you had gone to seminary in the 1870s in Germany, you would have been told that that all of the good scholars recognized the Gospel of John was written about 170, 180 AD. Why so late? Because it has such a high view of Jesus. And then along comes this little scrap of papyri that trashes all those scholarly theories in one blow, and I love that kind of thing. Now, the story is there's been a major papyrus find, and we're waiting for the publication of the material that will actually promise to have new manuscripts that are earlier than this. Now, of course, it's going to take years to examine those things and verify those things. Right now, this is the earliest we've got. It may not be the earliest for much longer, but I am such a geek that I even made a tie out of P52. Not the original, of course. But there you are in my debate with Bart Ehrman, and you'll see my tie is both sides of P52 fully readable. I want to emphasize the fully readable part. And there I am giving a copy of my tie to Bart Ehrman, and that was about the only time during the debate that he smiled. So that was a major accomplishment on my part that I got Bart Ehrman to smile. I do not know what he did with the tie. Did he burn it? Does he wear it once a year to mock the weird fundamentalist guy that he debated? I don't know, but we'll let that go. Now, please do not ask me any questions about this next manuscript. Please ask your pastor. Okay, he has no idea, but I'm going to leave it all on him anyways. Okay, so just go from there. This is the one of the earliest fragments we have of the Book of Revelation. The Book of Revelation. Now, what is the number of the beast. Stop that. 666. Okay. Now, problem is that in the two earliest manuscripts we have of the book of Revelation, and this is one of them. I'll blow up the fragment here so you can see it. It doesn't say 666. It says 616. 616. Now, if you want an interpretation of that, as I said, not my church, not my job, okay? I'm not going there. But I think Dan Wallace of Dallas Seminary has come up with the best interpretation of this possible. And that is, he says 666 is the number of the beast, but 616 is the number of the neighbor of the beast. I have to let that one settle in every time I tell it, but it's one of my favorite jokes. Textual critical jokes. Oh, they're so much fun. My wife got tired of textual critical jokes a long time ago. Let me tell you something about that. Anyways, this is P72 from around AD 175 to 200. That is such a good scan of it that you can actually read it. Up at the top, it says Petru Epistolae Bay. That's the beginning of 2 Peter. On the left is the end of 1 Peter. And I got to see this exact page in the in 1993 during the papal visit to Denver. They had it on display there. I almost got in trouble because I was spending so much time reading it, and people didn't think you were supposed to do that. What's really neat about this, did anybody read the Da Vinci Code? Anybody read the Da Vinci Code? Well, the theory there was, Constantine made up the deity of Christ at the Council of Nicaea and stuff like that. And in fact, I heard somebody saying the Trinity was designed at the Council of Nicaea within the past couple of days, in fact, in one of my debates. But I love this because here you have documented evidence. Let's blow this up here. And that is a Granville-Sharp construction. If you know 2 Peter 1:1, you know it refers to our God and Savior, Jesus Christ. And so here in a manuscript from 175 to 200, long before the Council of Nicaea, you have Peter's words describing Jesus as our God and Savior, both the terms God and Savior applying to the one person, Jesus Christ, in the original language. Then we have this Gospels manuscript, P75, also from around 175 to 200. That's the beginning of the Gospel of John. And we have P66, which is also a Gospels manuscript, and it's also the beginning of John. You have that wonderful phrase, and the Word was God. Just blow it up there real quick. I like this particular image of P66 because you can see what the book looked like rather than just a single page. And you can see especially what would happen to papyrus. The where the spine is, that's handled age pretty well. But where do all of our books get damaged? They get damaged on the outer corners primarily, and especially the lower corner, especially if it's put on a shelf or something like that. So you can sort of see this damage that goes like that, which we're going to see in the next one, which is manuscript P46. And this one's very interesting. If you look right down toward the bottom, it says Pros Philippiacus to the Philippians. P46 is our earliest collection of Paul's epistles. Now, I am on the other side of the planet from my homeland. When I'm in my own homeland, when I take this little quiz of people, I take a little vote from everybody, everybody gets scared, and they won't answer the question. I'm going to ask you a question. I want everybody to vote. I want you to express an opinion. I want to see if South Africans are a little bit more brave than Americans are, okay? Now, what's the one book of the New Testament where we go, we have no idea who wrote this? The book of Hebrews. Exactly. There's no name attached. Some people go, I know Paul wrote that. Well, we can have a discussion about that. But says it in my Bible right there, Epistle of Paul to the Hebrews. Now, here's the quiz. Do you think the earliest collection of Paul's epistles had Hebrews in it or did not have Hebrews in it? Okay. I'll give you 3 seconds to make up your mind. And so how many of you think P46 contains the book of Hebrews? Put your hand up. How many of you think it does not contain the book of Hebrews? I think, how many of you, despite my begging, did not vote anyways? See? See? I saw you. I saw you. What are you, Americans or something? Come on. Man. See? Well, for those who care, it does contain the book of Hebrews. In fact, it's found right after Romans. So it is early on. So all that tells you is, whoever copied P46 thought that Paul wrote to Hebrews, but that's about the extent of that. Now, as I said, I'm a bit of a geek. This is me down when I was in. Some of you have been asking, "Oh, have you gotten to see anything in South Africa?" Yes. When driving out to Potchefstroom, a herd of cattle went across the road in front of us. That was exciting. I took pictures of it, and that's about all I've seen. Other than that, I did see two zebra today. I saw a zebra today, so I'm feeling very Africanized there. So, anyways, but this is when I was down in Sydney, Australia, and I had half a day to go see the sights. So, did I go see the Opera House? Did I go see the Sydney Bridge? No, I went to Macquarie State University because I knew they had a fragment of manuscript P91 there. And there I'm holding all of P91 from AD 250. It's from the book of Acts, the end of chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 3. Had a lovely conversation with the curator, who, again, he and I like to talk about things that, well, actually nobody else likes to talk about at all. So we had a lot of fun. Then after the peace of the church, I remember up until 313 AD, Christianity was a religio illicita, an illegal religion. And so after 313, you have the peace of the church, the persecution against the Christians stops. And so you would be able to have a more extensive manuscripts made. You'd be able to utilize more professional scribes and things like that. And so that's when the great manuscripts begin to show up, such as Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And so Sinaiticus and Vaticanus may be amongst the Bibles copied with imperial monies at the time of the Council of Nicaea in AD 325. I want to show you very quickly what Sinaiticus looks like. There you see Sinaiticus as I saw it in the British Library in 2005. And right next to it was Codex Alexandrinus. But I want you to see the writing. Now realize, this is handwritten. This is not printed. This is handwritten. It's amazing the regularity of the lettering. But you will still notice there's a marginal note in the second column, first column. There's two of them in the first column. There's some writing in between the lines in the fourth column over on the right-hand side. This is a manuscript that was in use from about 325 AD, or 325 to 350 AD, until its discovery by Constantine von Tischendorf in the 1850s, late 1859. So you're talking about 1,500 years this thing is in use. And so obviously during that period of time, that people would have been making emendations or notes or things like that over the course of 1,500 years. Now you can go to codexsinaiticus.org, and there you will find high quality, high resolution digital photography of Codex Sinaiticus. And even two different kinds of light. You can even have straight-on light or raking light, so you can actually see the surface of the actual manuscript right there. And it is amazing what is available to us today when it comes to that kind of information. Now, very, very quickly, we also have Codex Vaticanus. There is Vaticanus right there. Again, one of the great unseals in Codex Alexandrinus. And I even have a tie made of Codex Alexandrinus, too. So, but it's for witnessing to Muslims, and I don't have time to tell you about it, but it's really cool. So we go back to just the facts here. Now, aside from the 5,700-plus Greek texts, we have early translations into Latin, Coptic, Sahidic, etc., that are important witnesses to the early texts of the New Testament, so other language versions are very important. Combining these, the Greek text yields over 20,000 handwritten witnesses. We have more than 124 Greek manuscript witnesses within the first 300 years after the writing of the New Testament. Notice this line, far more than any other work of antiquity. There is no other work of antiquity that comes close to having this kind of manuscript witness. And therefore, if someone's going to question the validity of the text of the New Testament, to be consistent, they're going to have to question the validity of all works of antiquity. And almost none of them are willing to do that, though some, of course, actually are. In fact, we have 12 manuscripts from the second century. That is, within 100 years of the writing of the New Testament. These manuscripts contain portions of all four Gospels, 9 books of Paul, Acts, Hebrews, and Revelation, comprising majority of the books of the New Testament we possess today. Again, no work of antiquity even comes close to this early attestation. In fact, the average length of time between the writing of most works contemporaneous in the New Testament, such as the historical works of Pliny, Tacitus, Suetonius, and their first extant copies is between 500 and 900 years. Now, think about what that means. 500 to 900 years is the average time between when those works were written and our first manuscripts. We have 124 within the first three centuries, and we have a dozen within the first 100 years. No other work of antiquity has that. In fact, here's a graphic that sort of illustrates this for you from a fellow down in Australia. If you look over on the right-hand side, you see a circle marked Homer. That's the number of manuscripts we have for Homer's works. I have 643. And the distance out from the dot in the center is the number of years between when it was originally written and our first manuscripts, which for Homer is right at 500 years. Sophocles, we have 193, but it's 1,400 years between when it was first written and our first copy of it. You can see that all those, you know, poor old Plato out there is 1,400 years, and he only has 7 manuscripts. So that's why people don't read a lot of Plato, I guess. But you can just see the big old thing on the left is not the sun. That's the New Testament, okay? 24,000 manuscripts. You see how close it is to the origination point. And so, again, if you're going to say, yeah, that document there, which Bart Ehrman said in our debate, is the earliest attested document of all of antiquity, if you're going to say we don't know what that originally said, then you're going to have to join the radical skeptics and say, basically, we know nothing about history. We don't know what any of these books ever said. We know nothing about history whatsoever. The only thing we can really know about history is stuff that's etched on a rock. And even then, you can't be 100% certain. So, you know, you've got radical skepticism or you've got meaningful scholarship. Now, often the transmission of the text of the New Testament is likened to the phone game. Now, I'm not sure, which the terminology do you use down here? Phone game or Chinese whispers? Okay, so it's like when, you know, if I were to reach over here and I was to whisper something to this fellow and he whispers it and whispers. Once it gets to the back, it's going to be probably, if I do it in English, it'll be in Afrikaans by the time we get to the back. You know, I mean, this is all there is to it. And maybe go through a few language permutations in the way. That's normally the way that people like Bart Ehrman present the transmission of the text of the New Testament, is you have one copy, and then you have a copy of that, and a copy of that, and a copy of that, and you keep getting errors, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse the more you go down the line. But that is not how the New Testament manuscripts were transmitted to us in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I have a graphic here, and I hope you all will be very kind to me, because I actually made this graphic myself, and I'm not necessarily a big techno geek, so I don't even know if it works right. Oh, it's not even going to work right. On my regular computer, all those little manuscripts move over to another place on the map, and it's really cool, but it's not going to work right now, so I'm just going to skip it. But let me just mention the important element of this. I can make it work someday, but I'll have to work on it. It's the iPad thing. New Testament manuscripts were written by multiple authors. There wasn't just one author in the New Testament. They were written to multiple audiences, multiple locations, at multiple times. So this multifocality of the New Testament means that you have manuscripts being produced at different times, going to different places, and what that means is you end up with different lines of transmission. For example, when Paul writes his letter to the Colossians, remember what he says? Read the letter that's coming from Laodicea. Now, how many of you have read Laodiceans recently? Anybody read Laodiceans? I bet you have. It's called Ephesians. Have you ever noticed that how long did Paul stay in Ephesus? 3 years. 3 years. Have you ever noticed something about the book of Ephesians? There's nothing personal in it. There's no personal greetings. There's no greet so-and-so in their house and blah, blah, blah that you have in all the others. Why might that be? Because Ephesians was clearly meant to be a circular letter. It was meant to be a letter sent to the main church in Lycus River Valley and then passed around all the churches in the valley. That was the letter that Paul was saying to the Colossians. Read that one too. You'll notice there's a lot of parallels between Ephesians and Colossians. And so what would happen is that letter would be go around the churches, and before they would pass it on to the next church, guess what they did with it? They would make a copy of it. And so you end up with multiple streams of transmission of that one. It's not just one to the next to the next to the next. You have multiple streams of transmission. This also had to happen because the Romans eventually started killing Christians who had the Christian scriptures. And so if there hadn't been multiple lines, the Christian scriptures would have been destroyed long ago. We found a papyri just recently. The documents in the 300s, the early 300s, the Romans going into a church in Egypt, sounds like what's going on today, and sacking the place and destroying 300 manuscripts in one church. And so what you have are many streams of these books going from different places at different times. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean to us in many different ways? First and foremost is these multiple lines. These multiple lines, they were written lines. They weren't what would be whispered to someone. What's whispered to you is easier to forget than what is written down. Handwritten documents are obviously, you can't have textual variation, but you're going to have much more consistency in a handwritten document than you are what's whispered in the ear. But more importantly than that, what you need to understand, this multifocality, multiple authors, multiple places, multiple times, leads us to the final considerations that demonstrate the bankruptcy of the modern attacks on the New Testament. For example, to make specific changes in a text like the New Testament, which originally circulated as a group of texts, not as a single body, would require a centralized controlling body that could make wholesale changes in these widely dispersed texts. The fact of the matter is, there never was. There never was such a central agency in the history of the Christian church. None could have ever even existed. Up until 313, we were a persecuted minority. There was no papacy. There was no group that controlled these texts. The New Testament wasn't even circulating as a single body during that time. Christianity was a persecuted religion made of mainly the lower classes. There was no central authority that could have ever have gathered up all the texts and made wholesale changes. Such was impossible in the earliest days of transmission. And given that we have such ancient texts now, obviously could not have happened at a later point without giving clear evidence of it happening. In fact, we can prove beyond all doubt that this kind of corruption did not happen, since papyri have been found that date back to the 2nd century, and that only within the past 100 years. Had any later centralized organization sought to alter or change the text, those later texts would show stark differences as older and older manuscripts are found. But just the opposite has been the case. So in other words, if there had been someone come along, and the theory is always, there was an actress in the United States named Shirley MacLaine. Anybody know who Shirley MacLaine was? Oh, some of you are going, yeah, okay. She went off and got into this New Age weird stuff and started doing strange things. And she put out a movie called Out on a Limb where she's walking along the seashore and her guru is telling her to say, I am God, I am God, I am God. And we're all sitting at home going, no, you're not, no, you're not, no, you're not. And she would go around telling people that, well, reincarnation used to be in the Bible, but they took it out of the Council of Constantinople. Now, the brother over here, got it. I always look around, so I'm not picking on you. The brother over here just went, tch. When was the Council of Constantinople? Anybody in here know when the Council of Constantinople? That's the Council of Nicaea. 381. Are you Googling? We have a church historian amongst us. Thank you very much. Actually makes my heart glad. I'm going to be teaching church history in Kiev, Ukraine in February. I'm going to freeze to death, but I'm going to have a lot of fun. But it's great to know that someone knows. Most of us don't even know when the Council of Constantinople or what it was talking about. And yet that's the kind of assertion that's being made. How do we respond to it? Well, the reality is, of course, that if something had happened in 381, where they tried to insert or take out the doctrine of reincarnation, we have manuscripts from before 381. And they could have only controlled a certain number of manuscripts because they could not control all the manuscripts that existed in that day. And so when we find older manuscripts, those changes would be very obvious, and no such obvious changes exist in the manuscript tradition at all. So that kind of assertion is simply impossible in light of the historical evidence itself. So all allegations of purposeful corruption, such as those made by Muslims, fall upon the mere consideration of the historical context and data itself. The rapid, widespread distribution of the New Testament manuscripts in the first two centuries precludes any purposeful centralized corruption. It also gives rise to the need to study the relatively small number of textual variants. But this leads to another important point, and this is really the one you need to grab hold of this evening. When scribes copied their texts, they were very conservative, often incorporating marginal notes into the text, since they could not be sure if the note was original or not. Now, let me ask you a question. Does anybody have an NIV or ESV in the audience? Which one's that? ESV. Since you were kind enough to volunteer and got the Council of Nicaea rather than the Council of Constantinople, I don't want to repeat this for folks, but since you did that, could you read for me John chapter 5, verse 4? All of you, if you've got a Bible, take a look at John chapter 5, verse 4. I'd just like you to read that for me real quick. Yes. Oh, that's okay. Just go ahead. That's exactly right. There is no verse 4. It goes from 5:3 to 5:5. Now, how many of you will honestly say, that bothers me? Okay, good. That's good. Now, why is there no verse 4? It's at the bottom of the page, if you look. It's in that teeny, 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 tiny print that I can't read anymore. It looks like a smudge at the bottom of the page now that I'm past 40, actually past 50. But it's down there at the bottom. They give you a little textual footnote. They tell you it's there. It's a story about the angel troubling the waters. It is not a part of the original New Testament, but since the New Testament that was numbered verse-wise in 1550 by Stephanos was the Byzantine text, it had it, and so that's why a number was assigned to it. That's why it looks like a missing number, but in reality, it's just the numbering system was assigned to a later text. That was a marginal note that someone had put in the side of a margin, and then a later copyist inserted it into the text as an explanation of what was going on. That happened a couple of different places, and we can recognize that happening. And it's a good thing that it happened. Now, let me explain why. What I'm getting to is that the New Testament demonstrates something called tenacity. Once a reading appears in the New Testament, it stays in the New Testament, even if it's absolutely inane and silly. I use the illustration of one particular manuscript where the scribe was copying a manuscript that had two columns, and it was in the genealogies of Jesus. And one day he just was not paying attention. And so instead of copying down one column and then the next column, he copied across the columns. In the genealogy of Jesus, God has a daddy named Ferris. Now you go, how could he not notice that? He was having a bad day. Haven't you ever had a bad day like that? Maybe he was sick. I don't know why he didn't notice it, but we still have the manuscript. We still know he made this mistake. Now, are we confused about the genealogy of Jesus because of that? No, but the point is, even silly readings stay in the text. And you go, that doesn't sound good to me. It should, because you know what it means? It means the original readings stay in the text too. You see, if people were trying to edit stuff out and take stuff out, what if they make a mistake? What if they make a mistake and take the original reading out, thinking it's the wrong one? It is good to have a tenacious text. So what we have, what we as scholars who examine the New Testament text, what we have is, it's like, and I think this is one of the best illustrations anyone's ever come up with, and I didn't come up with it, Rob Bowman did. Rob Bowman came up with an illustration. He said it's like having a 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and we have 10,100 pieces. It's far better to have 10,100 pieces than it is to have 9,900 pieces. Anybody do jigsaw puzzles? Ever done a huge one? You get to the end and there's one piece missing. The cat got it at 12 o'clock in the morning. I don't know what happened to it, but you do all that work and there's one piece missing. The point is, folks, we are not missing any pieces. Now, what that does mean sometimes is we have to go, okay, you want an illustration? I think I've got just about enough time to give you an illustration to actually work through a textual variant with you. I like doing that so that you can see this is not just something for the esoteric scholars to be doing in their studies someplace. I like bringing people along and helping you to see what's going on. Take a look in your Bibles at 1 Timothy 3:16. 1 Timothy 3:16. Compare the King James and the New American Standard Bible. King James says, "And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on the world, received up into glory." Compare the New American Standard. "By common confession, great is the mystery of godliness. He who was revealed in the flesh was vindicated in the spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on the world, and taken up in glory." Now that is a big variant theologically, because there's a pretty big difference between saying God was manifest in the flesh and saying he who was manifest in the flesh. And my King James only friends, and there are King James onlyists out there, they don't like me much. They don't invite me over for dinner. I'm not on their Christmas card list, anything like that. But they will preach entire sermons about how the godless liberals have taken God out of 1 Timothy 3:16 because they don't believe in the deity of Christ. Now, in reality, I could show you another variant of John 1:18, which is the exact opposite of this, where the modern translations identify Jesus as God and the King James doesn't. So we could, you know, put the shoe on the other foot, but we're not going to do that. Why is there such a difference? I mean, that looks like a pretty major difference, right? All right. Well, once again, let's take a look at the information. Here it is. And you can see in the fourth line in the Greek, there's a little word has, and there's a little, I don't know what to describe. It looks like sort of a step or something like that with a dot into it. You look over here, and you'll see that same little thing, and the second line says theos, and it gives you the manuscripts that give theos. And then down below it, TXT means the text and the manuscripts that give that. I'm not going to expect you to interpret those things, though I do want to emphasize the fact that it's really, 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 really wonderful and very important that any of us have access to this information. You can get it all online. You can get it in electronic format. You can get it in printed format. In other words, we Christians are wide open with our text. Nothing's hidden. You cannot find this kind of information about the Quran. They haven't come up with a critical edition of the Quran yet. They have textual variants, but most of them just don't know anything about it, as we saw at Northwest University. But this still doesn't tell you why there is a difference. Let me show you what the two lines would have looked like in the majuscule text, and then I know I got this one right. I will use color to show the difference. There's the difference. Now let me blow it up so you can see what the difference is. There's the difference between God and he who. Real similar, aren't they? And in fact, the only difference between them is a little line above and a little line within the theta. And what was the original New Testament written on? Papyrus. And what did papyrus have in it? Lines. And so theos and hos. See, for some reason, Christians did this, and I didn't take the time to show you this, but for some reason, Christians developed this thing called nomina sacra. They abbreviated the divine names, God, Jesus, Lord, Spirit. They abbreviated them, and they put a line over top. And only Christians did it. That's how you can tell a Christian manuscript from a non-Christian manuscript in the ancient world. Well, theos is the nominative form of God. Normally, it would be theta, epsilon, omicron, sigma, theos, but they took that out. It's just theta, sigma, and so it looks just like the word hos. And down below here, I have Codex Sinaiticus, and you can see that a much, 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 much later hand tried to correct it. You got the little three little dots, and then they put theos there, but you can see the original reading was hos, who was manifest in the flesh. And so there's no reason to think about some kind of a conspiracy or someone's trying to change something. This is a simple error of sight. Nothing more to it than that. Nothing more at all. And once you look at the text in its original language, you're able to see these things. And so I think it's always good to demonstrate this. So quickly, in summary, leaving approximately, I believe, 7 minutes. Yes, approximately, maybe. Yes, you're supposed to nod your head up or down, sideways. That sounds good? Okay. In summary, 400,000 variants, but 99% of them are inconsequential. Most thoroughly documented work of antiquity. Spread all over the world quickly. No controlling authority ever had the ability to change it, redact it, edit it, so on and so forth. And any later editing would stand out clearly in comparison with the ancient manuscripts. Wow. That's a 90-minute presentation in 54 minutes. Or I guess I got started a little bit earlier than that. So that is a very, very, very fast run, but hopefully it has given you at least some idea of why it is that we can trust the New Testament documents and manuscript tradition. So, with that, I guess we have a few moments, maybe.
Yeah, maybe one or two questions. But I want to encourage you though that the ancient character.
Okay, let me sort of try to categorize that for you. Outside of the New Testament, we have what are called the patristic writings of the early church fathers. And we have the apostolic fathers, such as Ignatius of Antioch, writing before 107, 108 AD. We have Justin Martyr. We have these early writers. And they quote from Scripture as well. And the question is, isn't that a further evidence and proof of the reliability of the New Testament? Yes, but I personally really think that the manuscript tradition is significantly more weighty, and this is why. First of all, many times we can't tell whether they're quoting or paraphrasing. So sometimes there are major variations. Secondly, their own writings had to be passed down over time. And so we don't really have a super thorough critical text of their own quotations and their own writings. And so someone quoting, someone who's copying Justin Martyr might fix his citation based upon their knowledge of what a text should be rather than upon what it originally was. And so the patristic sources demonstrate the New Testament books were in circulation, they were familiar, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as actually the readings, I think they have to take a much more secondary role than the actual manuscripts themselves because of those considerations. But you're exactly right. Very clearly, all the early church writers were aware of major portions of the New Testament, and the farther you go, then the more of the New Testament they know of. Yes. There is one. Is there a second? Any other? Yes, sir. The Hebrew Roots Movement, yes. Right. Yeah, no, I haven't done much work on it because, to be perfectly honest with you, there just isn't much in the way of scholarly support. First of all, the idea that the New Testament was written in Hebrew, the only book of the New Testament where any argument can be made whatsoever is in regards to the book of Matthew, because Papias, I believe it is makes a reference to the Gospel of Matthew written in Hebrew. But even that is highly questionable. It's painfully obvious that the Gospels were actually originally written in Koine Greek. It would be absolutely inane for the Apostle Paul to write to the church at Colossae in Hebrew. There wasn't anybody there who could read it. You write to people in the language they can understand. So on any scholarly level, this is really just a way of getting people sort of off the beam and off the balance into something unusual and strange. The New Testament was written in Koine Greek. It was not written in Hebrew. And even then, it is interesting that I have sort of watched a couple of the videos of these folks. I know enough Hebrew to go, really. It's major stretches in a lot of this stuff. And part of it's because what they can do is Hebrew, like Arabic and the other Semitic languages, is based on triliteral roots of three letters. And back in the Bible code days, people were making up all sorts of stuff, because you can take three letters and do lots of things with it. You can find people's names and do all sorts of things. It just becomes a big puzzle that you're just playing with, rather than actually being concerned about what the message of the words originally were, the way that they're written, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, to be honest with you, that movement would not exist if it were not for the internet. It would not exist if it were not for the internet. I've got a waving hand back there. So, okay. Rudolph, grab your favorite book right behind you there and hold it up for everybody. Not mine, Dr. Kruger's. Come on, you know what I'm talking about. It's right there. There it is. There it is. Okay, Rudolph is holding up an excellent, excellent book, The Canon Revisited by Dr. Michael Kruger. That's the book that you need to get. Please do not run back there and run him over. He needs to take me to the airport. That is a new book that just came out. I do address some of the similar issues, but not nearly as in-depth in my book, Scripture Alone. But fundamentally, the issue of that's the issue of the canon, which is related to what I've just been talking about here, but it also has a different realm of dialogue and discussion to it, and you'll find that book to be an excellent excellent work on that particular subject. I happened to see it back there. I went, yes, excellent, excellent books here.
Ladies and gentlemen, James White, let's give him a hand. Again, I would like to remind you, tomorrow evening, 8:30, if you're suffering from insomnia, that's the place to be. 8:30, it's a debate between him and Shabir Ali at the Inirasmia at the Abu Bakr Mosque. Well, ask around, where's the debate? I'm pretty sure everybody will know. And then on Tuesday, he's debating at the University of Pretoria, IT227. What's the topic for that debate? It's cool when he says it in motion. Is that the question? No. All right. Guys, thank you so much for coming. Please make use of the book table over there. Please make use of the coffee table. And please make use of the gate when you go out. And thank you so much for coming. If you want to know a little bit more about Dialog, also I would like to remind you, before the music starts to play, that next week John Gilchrist is going to speak on the Muslim challenge. He's had 40 years of erfaring with Muslims. He's very good, and his English is also much better than mine. Thank you so much for coming, and good night.